on this beautiful day. Tomorrow evening we start a sesshin. And I want to take a different twist on this part of the Heart Sutra. Therefore, in emptiness, no form, no feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness, no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, no color, sound, smell, taste, touch, or object of mind. This is from one of the three young Americans who were imprisoned in Iran for a couple years. He writes, "To write about solitary confinement is to provide the texture of experience. But how do I provide the texture of an experience whose essential quality is its texturelessness? Solitary confinement is not a head banging against the wall in terror or rage. Sometimes it is, but mostly it's just the slow erasure of who you thought you were. You think you are still you, but you have no real way of knowing. How can you know if you have no one to reflect you back to yourself? Would I know if I was going crazy? It all must happen imperceptibly in here, like a frog being boiled to death. The longer I am alone, the more my mind slows. I'm losing my capacity to think. I'm becoming an animal, just looking and feeling. They make time the object of our hatred. Time here becomes different from anything I've ever known. We need events, and events are almost always interactions to give shape to time. Here, time stops being something that moves me and everything else constantly forward from the past to the present, from the known to the unknown. It stops being a stream and becomes a shallow, fetid pool. I sit in it and wallow. I can't drain it. I can't move forward. But somehow I always bear it. As tortuous as the thought of the future feels, I can endure the present. No matter how tight the vice grips my chest, I always endure this minute. So that's what I do. I live from one minute to the next, and I try not to look at the light." Yesterday, 2 days ago, my Dharma brother Lance and I went to visit our Bodhisattva brothers at the great monastery in Kalinga, which is named after Coaling Station A, where the trains would come through and fill with coal. It's called Pleasant Valley in the wasteland of the Central Valley, that when you're there in August, it's hard to imagine it being pleasant.
Mm. You called it a monastery? Is that right?
So one of our brethren, he writes, this is from nearly 20 years ago, Marcos wrote this. It was evening and chill and overcast, and the yard was out. 500 guys in blue and white were lifting weights, playing basketball, handball, and soccer, walking counterclockwise around the track, talking bull, ventilating anger, hatred, and fear. After my jogging, I was cooling down, feeling the hardness of the asphalt under my feet, taking 4 steps for an in-breath, 5 for an out-breath, slowly calming down mind and body. One of my homeboys, friends, caught up with me and started talking about the usual prison bull. "Hey man, do you remember so-and-so? I heard he got shanked in the neck on the other yard. Seems like he owed some something from the last prison. Man, I knew that dude was no good. Like in any conversation, one thing leads to another, and I found myself saying, heck, man, I don't like these gloomy, cold days. Weather like this depresses the bejesus out of me. My homeboy just shrugged and said, when it's hot, it's hot. When it's cold, it's cold. That's all. Boom! It hit me like a 357 slug. All of a sudden, all that stuff I'd been reading about made sense. I was too buried in desire and aversion to observe the true nature of things, too attached to concepts and fixed ideas to just observe, too busy with my likes and dislikes to just let things be. This was the suffering produced by my ignorant mind. The Four Noble Truths were right in front of me, brought to light in a few words spoken by a guy who didn't even know who the Buddha was. I don't quite get the Dharma yet. There will be a few thousand lifetimes before I do, but that realization brought me some peace, some ease, a new way to see things. Now I just walk step by step, each now followed by another now. Sometimes confused, sometimes in wonder, but I'm here, walking, just for the walking, watching the Dharma parade. So we go visit these guys, and we were wondering what we could talk about with them. And Marcos, he's been in for 35 years.
It was either 27 or 37. I didn't quite catch it. What difference does it make? That's
but about 20 years ago, he wrote a letter to various Buddhist groups to ask him to come visit. And this group out of San Diego started visiting the prison where he was in the south, in Imperial County near the border. And he was recently transferred to Pleasant Valley, where we go. And like about three, four months ago, and the same Buddhists that he'd written to 20 years ago came back through to visit. And they started coming because of his letter. That's the kind of guy this Marcos is. And how much longer he has in there, I don't think he's getting out. But when we got there, we were talking a little bit, and he just said he feels so unworthy that we even show up for them. And I made some kind of a snide remark. I don't know, it didn't feel like I really meant it, but it was like, in the last 2 days, I've been wearing that comment of his about unworthiness, and it's hard to embrace that. So we go visit these guys who get tiny glimpses of what we get to enjoy and basically ignore, mostly. So Lance asked a question. What was your question?
It was, what inspires you? How do you, you know, derive inspiration? Just continue your practice. Just continue living.
And what do you remember some of them saying?
It was a gamut of things that I thought would come up. Other people, you know, they're pointing to other prisoners and practitioners, or maybe not even, but, you know, that they admire. Nature came, and I said I would miss nature. But, and he said, like, glimpses. One of the fellows said he saw some couple of ducks one day, and that was, like, marvelous, you know. But, you know, their window is very tiny, and then they see one person talked about the sunrise and sunset when he could, they could still conceive the clouds. And we had hit on that, that might be one of the things. That was, I think, in the first block. And then in the second block, someone brought up something that the others didn't, their family. And many of the people nodded the same. Their family gives them inspiration to continue and to you know, to keep it like together, to be strong. One, I think the first person just said, gets his inspiration going inside and within. It was interesting. One of the things I was so struck by was there were two people there. And one of them said he loves it here, right? Francisco says that he loves it.
Well, solitary confinement.
I know that he said it, but didn't he also just say that he loved being there? Maybe I misinterpreted
him. I heard him talking about solitary confinement, that he actually enjoys his time in solitary confinement. He can, his life is full when he's alone.
And then the fellow from Arkansas, I forgot his name.
Gene.
He said that he found himself. Remember, he made it feel like we wanted to go. Stay here, you know. He made it sound. and I guess.
Any room?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of the same dilemma when we're going to do Seishin. Not anymore, but I used to have this mix of excitement and terror, you know, about doing the Seishin. Now it's most. It is sort of like putting yourself in a prison.
So these guys are in prison.
Yeah, that's right. The monastery, yeah, Pleasant Valley.
Oh,
you can see monastery.
Oh.
But weren't you struck by that? That they were, and there was not some fun. I mean, if it was funny, then they were great actors. But I believe they were really sincere. That you know, those two people especially. Felt that this had provided them with a great opportunity and discovered things about themselves that maybe they would not have otherwise.
The fellow from Arkansas, he'd been in construction all his life, had hunted and tracked and hiked in the Ozarks. He's from Arkansas. Been in construction, worked hard all his life, doing construction work and doing what he did and believing what he believed. And he did something in his mid-60s because he's a gray hair like me, and he's in the joint. And he's Christian. There's a big cross, but he's practiced meditation. But he just expressed gratitude for being there and finally seeing how ignorant his life had been.
He had an unusual comment about what inspires. He He said that in prison, now that he had his quiet, he would remember, even from his childhood, when he was tracking, he could see, like, the leaves. Remember? He could see the leaves, and every vein on the leaf would come to his mind, you know, the details, the very simple details. And it may have been a follow-up comment to someone else talking about just very simple things they appreciate. One person kept, two people, and both kept praying mantises as pets. Then he wants to be in season now. I think they do come popping out now.
They were wondering if feeding a bug to a praying mantis was killing life.
Yeah, I woke up thinking about that. I mean, you would think in a prison, I mean, these are hard, some of them are, right? Hardened criminals. Some of them are in for murder. And this one young fellow, I think he'd been a gang member, he had lots of tattoos. He was wondering whether it was, you know, he was violating the precepts by killing, bringing bugs to kill to bring to the praying mantis.
So our friend Marcos, who's probably in his mid-50s now, he's from, I think he's from Colombia or Venezuela originally. He's the Men's Advisory Council lead guy, the MAC, they call him. And he handed me this paper. I'll show you that lists what they want to do for the men. And basically, they want to bring college professors in and art instructors to come in and teach the men. And he said, "Doug, you'll be a good advocate for me."
Do you get paid?
For going?
Sorry. Total base.
I find, I know that history is replete with it. I find almost, I never find any humor in the mistreatment of any other human being. I felt my heart sink when you started talking about these prisoners that are, for all practical purposes, forgotten. Many of them are in there because they did things when they were under the influence of drugs and alcohol. And for me, that is the worst confinement, and solitary confinement is one of the worst things that can happen to any individual. And I'm saddened by all of it. Whenever I hear what's being done, I actually get angry when I happen to either read a newspaper or hear something on the news about the cruelty of the prison guards themselves, who are supposed to be public servants. And I don't know whether I could. I don't know how I would react if I went in like you all did. I don't know how I would react and how much more sad I would be realizing that we're kind of powerless over controlling the institutions that it's the courts, it's the prison guards, it's everything that make this just a nasty, nasty thing to do.
But they found a way.
I know. That's amazing to me. But not all people do.
When I went to in December, and I thought I was, what I know about prisons, I've been in jail a couple times, political protests, mostly from movies, you know. And I expected this really grim encounter. And like you, I mean, I feel the same way as you. But I come away from there happy. I mean, it's a very positive experience where this person felt unworthy, you know, that we come. I feel unworthy when they start thanking me for it seems so, you know, and sometimes I say, no, this is inspiring for me. There. It just illustrates or a present, a forceful example of the triumphancy of the human spirit over circumstances, which I think that's what this, at least part of what this in practice is about. They're really doing it, and it's wonderful to see them. For the most part, these people that are there, and maybe it's just because we're there, I don't know, they're like beaming. It's marvelous to see them.
I also had a feeling of this like sinking feeling about hearing your friend who reported feeling worthlessness. That's because it must just be such a lost feeling, you know, to feel like that you've been thrown away. Society didn't need you. And what I found myself wondering was if the message to people who made mistakes could include the fact that there were consequences for those mistakes, but so not like they just get off for free, but maybe as opposed to sending them the message that they're not needed and that they're worthless, if the message could be that they are needed. And that's why we need you to get better. You know, that's why we're here to help you. You know, and that process might be difficult, and maybe it includes being in prison. So it won't be easy for those people. But if the message, it seems to me like the message you bring for them, and perhaps why they're so grateful, is that they are needed.
They're needed by us,
yeah.
By me, and Lance, I think, feels the same way. I feel it's like I'm not going there to help them. Initially, I thought I need to go visit these guys, and I guess maybe there is help that we give, and that is this human contact from the outside, and the recognition that they're okay. And that we recognize them as our brothers. I used to call them the men. And then I emailed this priest in a San Diego Sangha. It's a complicated lineage. It has Tibetan, it has, it's Chan, and their lead teacher is from Taiwan. So, and
Deer Park, is
it? That's Thich Nhat Hanh.
Is it Atlanta?
This is in San Diego.
Oh, San Diego.
And he wrote back, and I said, you know, the men are going to really appreciate you coming. And he says, we always enjoy going visiting our brothers. Mm-hmm. And I just, yes, they're brothers. And there are brothers, you know, I've done a lot of drugs and alcohol, And I've had a lot of anger issues. And the first time I went in and sat with these guys, and, you know, you get a feel, you know. It's just one of these things that you don't really analyze. You just kind of feel who they are. You get a sense of their poise, their a little bit of their heart, and even if they don't say anything, just what's coming through their eyes. And it dawned on me that, but by the grace of God go I could be in there with them just that easily. I didn't kill anybody, I don't think. You know, when you're put on your brakes and people behind you are slowing down, you don't know what chain reaction you started.
But just given certain circumstances, everybody's got that potential.
Yeah. When I was in high school, I read a little story about a fellow who was arrested for stealing a candy bar. He was black, and he never got out of prison. Once he got in the system, yeah, it just kept, you know.
Chris?
I feel like those feelings you're talking about were, or maybe used to too, that some of these prisoners might feel like they've been discarded by society and deemed not useful. I suspect that perhaps that's how they felt even before they were in prison, and
mm-hmm.
feel like people, and I grew up in a sort of impoverished community, I feel like people are more driven to crime or to participate in situations that lead to crime when there are no, it feels like there are no stakes. There's nothing to lose.
And there's nothing to do.
There's nothing
else to do. But, hey, we're going to go rip off this. You want to go with us? Yeah, let's go. It's not a climb in a mountain. In a way, it is. It's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like when it's instilled in kids when they're young that they do have value, then they value their time and their actions in a different way. They hold it.
The relationship between the men, I notice there is deep trust between them and respect, deep respect and deep trust. And, you know, to have these guys who were brought up, like one of them that we're going to give precepts to, we're sewing a rakusu for him, and I've got it all pinned up ready to start sewing from City Center. He said his mom and dad were heavy into meth and alcohol, and they basically ignored him, and he just did what he wanted, and he had a, this is Chris in D Yard, and I you might have met him, but he wasn't there this last time, but he so much juice, so smart, you know. He reads through these Buddhist books and he reads them cover to cover maybe a couple of times, and he handed one to me. I start reading it, it's like, God, I can read a couple pages tonight. And he's so he's figured out a way to be an adult or be grown up in some way, and he holds on to these different Buddhist ideas, and then, of course, you got to let them go, because the next day you wake up, you know, you look at them again, and it's like, God, what does this mean? So, but he, one of the things I noticed is he watches after some of the other younger men, and giving them books that they can read, and whenever we're there, there's never enough time to spend and talk with them. And he shepherded this one young guy over to me who was going to be relocated in another prison. You know, what's the best book I can read? You know, and he just got him there. And, you know, you ask your question. You talk to Doug. You ask him what the best book is. you know, and he just was there making sure that he got his question to me and he got a reasonable answer. And instead of it being all about me, you know, here are these guys in prison are supposedly the pathological element of society. There are bad players there. And I've been manipulated in there too by little things. But basically, respect is met with respect. And trust is met with trust. And it's a privilege to be able to go. That's how I feel. Yes, Todd.
I think you've heard of this book called The Lucifer Effect. It's written by Dr. Zimbardo from Stanford, famous. It's in a similar vein. And the history of, he did a very famous prison guard experiment in the bottom of the basement in Stanford.
Oh, yes. And about how cruel people can be.
Not by the upshot of the book is how all of us, not some people, especially him, turns out he didn't even know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And he was the inventor of the experiment.
Right.
So what comes to mind, though, is that I used to try fasting. I did fasting. But I chose to do that, which is not my mental attitude, rather than somebody who's starving. This is a form of starving, but because of my attitude, because of my decision, my control, in a way, of deciding to do that, made all the difference in the world about what I was doing. So I started out reading the Heart Sutra. I chanted the Heart Sutra. I tried to remember some of the things in the Heart Sutra, but that comes from my free will to do that, to be here. That's really different, I believe, than just imposing authority. The reason why he wrote that book was he saw, as he was doing some lectures in Marta, why he saw on television the famous pictures of Abu Ghraib prisoners being electrocuted, which went all over the world. They came, a lot of those pictures came right from, not the electrocution, but what they did, came right from his experiment. That's what he found 30 years before. He had to do something. Because that somehow the authorities got a hold of what he had found out and they used it against those prisoners. It's horrendous what authority figures, and people who don't even know what they're even authority, what they do. So, that's one report.
The authorities have a lot of effect. They can make life really miserable. I think one of the first realizations is for a lot of these men that we get to see in Buddhist practice, it's like a self-selected group of men that come, is they are not going to get angry at what is done to them, because then the other guy is controlling them. So their willful control, you were talking about your fast, being a willful act. Many, many, many of these guys have expressed how their willful act to not be angered keeps them really empowering.
Can you say that again? The willful act that they don't have, you said?
The willful act to not get angry. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, we're going to open your doors in 5 minutes. Everybody stands at the door because they open the door and then they close it. Or they unlock it and they lock it again within like 5 seconds. And so everybody's standing there ready to go out, and then you got a PE. It's like, so you dash back to take a leak in your toilet in your cell. Meanwhile, click, click, and suddenly you're in for the duration of that day. You can go, damn, a damn card. So they just can shut that down and say, here I am. Lance.
There's still time. I feel remiss if I want to describe this one person, Ken.
Ken. K-E-N. He's a young Vietnamese.
Ken, a young Vietnamese. He's Thai, I think. Isn't he? Is he Vietnamese? Or maybe is he? Well, but he's this tiny. He seems like a little boy. He doesn't seem he could be in a men's prison. He's got like this elf deva-like quality to him. And he was sitting next to me, and I couldn't help but just to keep looking over at him, because there was just something marvelous about his countenance. He's like this golden boy, you know? And he speaks, but he speaks, it's very gentle. You say he's studying to be a priest. Mm-hmm. In Theravada tradition, and like any delusion that I might have that I'm coming there to teach something about Buddhism to someone like him, you know, to run him is just dispelled. It's just and it was what you said. It's not like I spoke with him in great detail, but just being his being. Encountering it, it's so striking. And in the context of being in this prison, it's so incongruent. I can't, you know, so like, how could he ever have arrived there? It's just like he must have been dropped from the sky somehow, because it just, I can't fathom the circumstances that could have brought him into that prison.
I was thinking about that, just as what you were talking about, inside prison, there's liberating possibilities, or can be a liberating experience inside a place of confinement. Just like that, so even in a very open and liberated place where you think you have free will, or you can determine your fate, there's still many, many prisons that we experience or we create. Maybe they understand that as well. That being out is not necessarily being free, and being inside is not necessarily being confined.
Yeah, there are boundaries. Though they may appear hard, may let light through.
Some of those prisons that you're describing, Michael, I have a feeling is the reason why those prisoners are in prison. Being unaware.
Then why we practice. Yeah, it's about your point of all the prisons we have and our ways we think are actually imprisoning. Like this guy from Arkansas who prejudiced white, having construction guy, so he's plenty of money to go do what he's doing, and he's got his gun probably, and he loves to track and hunt and trap, and yet he's, I think, probably saw how enshackled he was within those constraints until he's tasting this other. And so it's, in a way, these guys are there wasting time, wasting their lives away. And we go there here, you know, I got an important job and I'm an important person and I'm this and I'm that, you know. And it's just like the guys on the yard. Yeah, I did this and I did that and I'm so-and-so and I all this ego stuff. And it's just to be able to go in and I don't know. I guess I just feel like by being there with them and respecting them and hearing them gives a okay, yeah, we're not so different than these two jerks that just walked, not jerks, but these two funny looking guys that just walked in.
Eminent Buddhist, visiting Buddhist.
And then we hear stuff like what Doc, who's one of the prisoners, he comes up to Lance and he says, "The past, the present, and the future walked into a room. It was tense." And so it's like,
well, beat that, yeah.
What you said, you know, I got my life on that one of the fellows, not one of the prisoners, but one of, like, kind of the captain, but one of the, he said, "Look, I got a life outside of all this. I have family, I have life, and when I leave here, I don't even think about this place." And he was sort of contrasting, you know, "I got a life to these guys." And I wasn't going to say anything, but I'm thinking, like, no, you don't. You don't have a life out there and a life in there. It's all one life, you know. Mm-hmm. They have a life, too. We all have a life, you know. It's just, it's all a matter of meeting our circumstances moment by moment. And it's, you know, to think because he has some job or family and he gets to go out and travel around, go on vacation, but he has a life and they don't. That's just total delusion.
There's a famous person, Viktor Frankl, who wrote about the Nazi prison camp, and that was exactly what he found, the people that were able to survive that had something outside. Was that they did have something they really wanted to do, and also that they had somebody, they had experienced love. Those two things were the main reason why people survived.
Well, that's extremely grim, that situation. That's far more than what we're encountering here. But yeah.
Yes.
Is this a place near Soledad?
It's east of there, another hour and a half.
There may be another one near Soledad, but my friend who I was driving with was telling me that, you know, the community had formed because the families would move closer to the prison. So kind of a new town emerges around the prison, and I found that touching as well. But I also wanted to share, just on NPR this morning, it was interesting, they were talking about a Japanese prisoner who, it's fascinating.
Japanese prisoner? Mm-hmm.
Who had been on death row for 50 years and is potentially not guilty. So they're going to retry him rather than exonerate him He 50 years ago he had been accused of, you know, this one situation of multiple murders, and he confessed after interrogation and then later tried to retract his confession.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese judicial system is fascinating in that they don't tell the death row inmates when they will be executed.
Mm-hmm.
When, if they do tell, it would be an hour or two before the execution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's literally, they will, you know, if a prison guard comes to your door and say, get your affairs in order, it's an hour. And so, literally for 50 years, every day could have been the last day of his life. And so I'm sort of listening to the story, and it's all fascinating. And then the radio announcer said that, you know, this guy's like 68 or 70 years old, and he's getting out. But then the announcer said, you know, but by all accounts, his mind has gone crazy in those years.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart sank as well, because... I think maybe a little bit like, you know, Viktor Frankl, like some people can survive intact, right? And some people cannot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems like torture.
Mm-hmm.
I heard the same.
Yeah.
Perhaps, but I thought, well, you know, there are people like Viktor Frankl, and what Viktor Frankl has said has helped me a lot in my life, just in terms of like, what is a prison, right? But like, in a way, I think if you do see, you know, every day could be our last day of our lives, it could be a wonderful practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of meditation on death.
In a gentle context.
You know, perhaps, or just having a foundation of hope and love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what he totally lacked was hope.
Yeah.
In that situation.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
Yes, Melissa.
For me, I was really resonating with what you were saying, Christine. I definitely envision a world where we don't have any prison systems at all. Of course, that will take some time and transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, with children, it's all about the prevention, you know. I was so struck by when I was thinking back to when I was getting a job as a systems analyst, and I was applying at Lockheed Martin, and I had to go through all of this, you know, all these applications and interviews and this background check and, you know, like everything. Then I thought about, gosh, if I want to be a parent, there's nothing. I can just have a baby. And there's no qualifications. There's no check. There's no, like, how are you going to raise this individual? What kind of person are you bringing into society? And it's just like, wow, what a...
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's just confusing. Like, what are we thinking? There's no, like, a lot of support around, this is a human being. That's in the world, and also for me, mindfulness practice, social emotional learning, and all that, starting with babies and their prenatal.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a neuroscientist at an event last week, and she's like, we're talking about all of these things and prevention, and she's like, yeah, you know, start playing Mozart or when your babies and the like, all these different things, but continuing on that, how we nurture our children, and so that we have this awareness, and we don't need these prisons anymore. That's my dream.
There are some bad players. There are some really strong predators that want to do some harm. And so there is...
Psychopaths.
And how are they created? I mean,
sadists,
of course.
Yeah.
What was it?
Sadists.
Yeah.
They're like inflicting injury on other people.
And they've lost the ability to feel somehow.
Yes,
but
there's something
like
that can be healed.
The ability to feel.
Yeah.
And innately.
Yeah.
It's the cause and effect, really, right?
So, crux to it. So we have the prisons where we put those that are convicted, and then we have prisons where it takes a special code to get through the gate.
Mm-hmm.
into your 60,000 square foot prison cell with a 10-ton HVAC unit to cool your home, your cell, and your paintings, and your five cars.
And the golf course. Don't forget the golf course.
And so I don't know how we deal with psychopathic tendencies culturally unless we go both bottom and top. And there are bodhisattvas everywhere. And we know some in Pleasant Valley. So,
is that the real name of the prison?
Pleasant Valley State Prison.